The title of his message is Hope's Crescendo.
Okay, so that's a weird title, but it has a point. Of course, we know what a crescendo is. It's a series of events that build and build and build to a final climactic conclusion. We all have hope. We may not think about it. Sometimes what we hope for is in the back of our mind and it's not right there in the forefront. But I want to bring the question before us all today. What is your hope? And as a sidebar to that question, what is the greatest hope? And are the two the same? We all harbor some kind of hope, but how real is it? There's a lot of people in this world who have hopes for this and hopes for that. We had a president that presented us with what he called hope, and people find that what they hoped for wasn't necessarily the same as what other people hope for. Fact of life, I guess. But what is the real hope of humanity? We have that hope. The world does not. They can have religion, and religion generally will provide a certain kind of hope. But is it the kind that we have? Is it the kind that is important to the future of humanity? The kind of hope that is woven through God's plan for humanity. I made mention yesterday of the messages that we've heard so far in the feast. Early on, we heard of the power to become the sons of God. And a mention of the holy days as being a preview of foretold events. In the middle of the feast, we heard about building a foundation, living in anticipation, which kind of alludes to that hope, living in anticipation. Yesterday we heard about despair being the utter lack of hope. The world generally is in a state of despair. They may not realize it. They have their sports events, they have their hobbies, they have their things they like to do. Plenty of beer. But that doesn't provide any depth to people's lives. Because the world really doesn't have a hope for a happy future. Another thing we heard yesterday. A hope for a happy future. We could sum up our hope, perhaps, in something as simply stated as that. We hope for the millennial kingdom of God. That's our hope. It's not the world's hope. But there's something beyond that even. In Hebrews 11, verse 1, we read that faith is the substance of things hoped for with the evidence of that not seen. We can see that there is a connection between faith and hope. We have to have faith to be able to have a real hope. But what is our hope? And how does it factor in to how we live our lives? In Romans 4:13, there is a reference to the promise. And of course, the promise is the statement of what we should be hoping for. There was a promise made to Abraham. Romans 4:13, we can read of it. where it says, "For the promise that he should be heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed, or to his seed through the law." You don't attain it by legal means, but through the righteousness of faith. The promise that he should be heir of the world. And that promise extends not only to him and his seed, but to those who are Christ's. In Galatians 3:29, it tells us that those of us who are Christ's are become Abraham's seed and heirs according to that promise. That is the source, or that is the means to obtain the promise. We hope for what was promised, to be heirs of the world, to be the leadership in the world to come. That is our hope. But then again, we're physical. We're temporary creatures. There's no one of us that's going to live forever in the flesh. But part of that hope is something else. It is that event of being changed from flesh to spirit. And that brings us to the subject of the resurrections. The resurrections from the dead. Whether we're alive at the time this event takes place or whether we're waiting in our graves, the resurrection is the key to that change from flesh to spirit. That is what we hope for and all that that leads to. The resurrections from the dead are a key essential doctrine of God's church. We can read of it in Hebrews chapter 6, where it lists all seven. I'm going to presume that you know them well, so we can save a little time here. But it concludes with, of the seven essential doctrines of Christ, it calls them, it concludes with the resurrection and eternal judgment. Now, we know that the saints of God are exempt from judgment in the sense of condemnation, although we're being evaluated now. Judgment has come upon the house of God, it says. We understand that to mean not condemnation, but rather evaluation. There's two kinds of judgment. In any court proceeding, you don't walk in and go straight to sentencing. There's always the evidentiary period where the facts are presented before any decision is made. And that's the kind of judgment that we are undergoing at this time. We're the first. The world isn't being judged as we are. Their judgment comes later. Their evaluative judgment comes later. They're not being judged as we are. We're being judged to be candidates for the family of God. Big difference. The world's religions generally teach a line of thinking that doesn't really require a resurrection. Although those of them who know their Bibles at all admit, yes, there is going to be a resurrection, even though it may clash with another one of their teachings of the destiny that they state for the deceased. I mean, why would you need a resurrection? If what they teach is true, why would you need a resurrection, really? For what? And what if a mistake had been made to someone's destination? You know, think of what a scene that would be. Oh, what are you doing here, you know? You were supposed to be in that other place. You know, no. The world doesn't really have a good sense for the resurrections, why they're important, and why they are such a structural component to the plan of God. We do. We understand the resurrections. Perhaps as no other religious organization or religious genre does. We know why the resurrections are important. Hebrews 6:19 tells us that we're to be always ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within us. These verses that are familiar, I'm just going to go right over them quickly. We know that verse. But that passage, Hebrews 6, brings out something else. I do want to read it. Because it precautions us. Many times we're so willing to blurt it all out to people. It talks about being cautious about what we say to people when they ask us about the hope that lies within us. We have to understand who we're speaking to, where they're coming from, in order to give them the right answer, because it's so easy to turn people off. But I would think this subject of the hope that we have, the destiny that that hope speaks to, should be something that we can present to people in a way that won't turn them off. But in order to embrace that hope, in order to share that hope with anyone else, we have to understand God's plan of redemption. The world understands it to a point, but they don't understand the whole picture. And these days illustrate the whole picture. And it's why it's important that we observe them. We may think at times we've done this before, we know all that. No, it's important that we keep the whole picture fresh in our mind. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but the major eras of the plan of redemption are bracketed with resurrections. Did you ever notice that? The Christian era begins with Christ's resurrection, and it ends with ours. The millennial age begins with our resurrection and ends with the rest of the dead, what we know of as the second resurrection. Revelation 20 explains all that. The rest of the dead live not again till the 1,000 years were finished. Very obviously, there's 1,000 years between the first and the next, whatever number you put on it. Why is there a gap of 1,000 years? What happens with that next resurrection, the one that occurs at the end of the millennial age? What happens? Because there is the key. And I think it would be an important key, if we're ever to explain the hope that lies within us, that is an important key to draw the interest of someone who is not necessarily religious. Because here's what the world doesn't understand. In the next resurrection, after ours, in the resurrection that occurs after the 1,000 years, those people who lived and died and who never had a chance, who were never called, who really didn't know God, they might have been religious people, but they didn't really know God. They really didn't understand what was happening. They were basically misled by their denomination as to what God plans for mankind. It would be a great comfort to them to know that they or their relatives or their friends who were never converted don't face the lake of fire. They will be raised for a different purpose. Some of that we can see in Revelation chapter 20. It's a different resurrection than ours. They're going to be raised physical. They'll come back from the grave in a physical form. Revelation 20. Verse 7 brings us up to where we are in the time when 1,000 years are expired. We know of that. But then in verse 11, it says, and this is after Satan attempts to take over the headquarters city in Jerusalem called the Camp of the Saints. After that is concluded, verse 11, and I saw a great white throne and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. Imagine that. There's this great expansive space where you don't see clouds or sky or earth, just this massive space in which there is no visible object other than a huge contingent of people raised up to stand before this great white throne. Now, whether this image is literal or whether it's figurative, not prepared to say. But the point is, it gives us a graphic illustration of something that is going to occur at this point in time. Massive numbers of people, billions, are going to come up and stand before the great white throne for judgment. The world may look at that and say, that's standing for condemnation. Not so. Read on, verse 12. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God. And the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books, according to their works. There is a performance component here. The books, basically the Bible, is going to be opened to their understanding as it never was before. And that involves being given God's Spirit. No one can understand these books, really, without God's Spirit. This is a point in time. This great white throne is not for condemnation. The great white throne is an evaluative phase of judgment. Verse 11 and 12 basically refer to the resurrection that occurs after the 1,000 years. But verse 13 is different. This is another occasion. We don't always recognize the distinction. But 11 and 12 refers to one particular event. And 13 and on refers to another. In verse 13, the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them, and they were judged every man according to their works. At this point in time, we have enough evidentiary evidence to impose sentence. And that's what we see in verse 14. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. You don't read that in verse 12. This is different. This is the point in time when the lake of fire becomes employed for its stated purpose. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. The book of life is opened in verse 12. But in verse 15, the book of life is looked into to see whose names are in there. Now that gives us a question. We have the answer, I'm sure, but it poses the question, what is the book of life being opened for? And whose names are going to be in it in verse 15? Obviously, all who were in the book of life were raised immortal in the first resurrection. There's no more names in the book at that point in time. It would only be a record of who was raised in the first resurrection if that was what it was all about. But it isn't. You see, the book of life is going to be open again for the purpose of adding names into it. That's the only reason for that book to exist. It's not a book of condemnation. It's a book of life. Who is going to be awarded life? And this is at a point in time after the saints are raised immortal at the beginning of the millennium. God is giving us incredible information. We understand today, as another verse says, what the prophets looked into, desiring to know. The prophets knew some things. They knew to a point. But they didn't understand at the time what we have been given to understand today. And that's largely the result of the book of Revelation. They didn't all have that in the early years. What did the early church understand about the resurrections? As the old saying goes, what did they know and when did they know it? Well, there's an astounding passage in the book of Job that we should read. Job 19, verses 25-29. And when we understand when Job lived, how early in time this was, Job was very likely a contemporary of Abraham, way back, right after the flood. Job might even have known Noah, because Noah lived for, what, a century after the flood? He certainly knew Shem. But Job says, "For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another, though my reins be consumed within me." Job understood that there is going to be a resurrection. In 14, Job 14, Job tells us more about what he understood at that early date. And how did he know that? Interesting question. Job 14, verses 13 to 15. He says, "Oh, that thou wouldst hide me in the grave, that thou wouldst keep me secret until my wrath, till thy wrath be past, that thou wouldst appoint me a set time and remember me." Job asks, "If a man die, shall he live again?" His answer is in the affirmative. "All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change come. You will call, and I will answer you. You will have a desire to the work of your hands." Job looked forward to the resurrection. We don't know that he understood necessarily being raised in the spirit form. He talks about seeing him in his flesh. But Job understood. In Ezekiel 37, there's an interesting statement. This is, of course, the prophecy of the Valley of Dry Bones, which represent the whole house of Israel, both the house of Judah and the house of Israel, the two nations. He's speaking to them in verses 11 to 14. Ezekiel speaking, "Then said he unto me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones are dried, and our hope is lost. We are cut off for our parts." Just a pile of bones. None of them connected to their proper counterpart. hopeless. They have no hope. Well, they should have had a hope. Any who died after the time of Ezekiel should have known of this prophecy, that there was a hope of the resurrection. And he says in, which verse is it? He says, I will put my spirit within you. They had a hope, whether they realized it or not. But their lament is that they were without hope, they thought. In John 11, where'd it go? Martha was asked the question. This is just after Lazarus had died. John 11:23-24. Lazarus was still dead at this point in time. Jesus said unto her, your brother shall rise again. And Martha said unto him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. She understood something. She understood that there was going to be a resurrection. She knew that it was connected with the last day. But did she understand the resurrections to the degree that we do? This speaks to the belief system of the time. But there's a lot more to it. The resurrections are spoken of in Matthew 25 and Revelation 20. We could compare those two verses or those two passages and get a clear picture of the fact that there is multiple resurrections. In Matthew 25, it describes the sheep from the goats event. We're familiar with that. But in what resurrection are sheep and goats raised together? There's no goats in the first resurrection. And there's no sheep in the second, is there? When would the sheep and the goats come up together? Very simply, it must be much later in time. In fact, the sheep from the goats event is a picture of the final sentencing. That is the judgment. That is the day of judgment that we refer to. We tend to think of this day as being representing the great white throne judgment, which it does. But sometimes we think of that great white throne as being the final sentencing event. No, it's not. The great white throne judgment covers a span of time, at least a generation long, in which people who never had an opportunity are raised to have the opportunity that they were never given. But the conclusion of this great white throne period is what we read of in Revelation 14. In verse 14, and I've spoken on this chapter in times past that shows that this chapter 14 refers to the harvests of the world. It describes the first harvest and it describes the second. And in the second harvest, there's two phases or two pictures being presented here. Revelation 14, verse 14, and I looked, and behold, a white cloud. And upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle, a harvest instrument. And another angel came down out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, thrust in your sickle and reap, for the time is come for you to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. That is the point in time when the final harvest is going to take place. This alludes to that point in time when the sheep are divided from the goats. They come up together. They're intermingled. They have to be separated with the sheep set on the right hand and the goats on the left. This covers basically that same scene. You see the righteous reaped first by one like the Son of Man sitting on a white cloud. This is the white cloud sentencing, which concludes the great white throne judgment period. That's a distinction we need to make. When the white cloud happens, when this white cloud reaping happens, those who have become converted after the first resurrection will be raised and brought into the family of God and given the blessing that we have been given to be born of the Spirit. Back in our former days, in our former association, we always had the question, when would those converted after the first resurrection be brought into the family of God as spirit beings? And we had a number of different answers. I remember one distinctly, a world-famous evangelist was sidelined after one of his multi-hour messages once. We stood around and we asked him, when is this going to happen? And his answer was that they would be made spirit beings as they qualify. And that, I think, was the teaching at the time. In other words, people would be born into the family of God on an ongoing basis during the millennium and after, as they qualified. Interesting possibility, but someone reading one of my Resurrections booklet brought this quote to me once. And I think it answers a lot, if I can find it. It's in Matthew 13:43. I never noticed this verse before. But it's Christ speaking, red letter edition, Matthew 14. Must be true. And it gives us a good sense. He answers the question, imagine it. I'm going to start in verse 41. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and them which do iniquity, and shall cast them into a furnace of fire. There shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. We know that has to be the final sentencing event for this lake of fire to be employed. But look what it says in verse 43. Then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Who has ears to hear, let them hear. Verse 43 is not talking about the first resurrection. It's not talking about the saints made spirit. This is talking about the people who are deemed righteous in the final sentencing event. They are going to be made spirit after the last judgment. It answers the question. Those who are converted during the millennium will live and die as people do now. They'll go to their graves and they'll await the day when they are raised for final sentencing. And that's the event we see. That's where the sheep come from in the sheep from the goats event. That's the final sentencing. That's the righteous that we read of in Revelation 14 who are reaped by the Son of Man on the white cloud. After the final sentencing is accomplished, these righteous will be changed from flesh to spirit and will join the family of God just as we did more than 1,000 years before. We have a hope. We know these things. We understand the plan, how it works. We understand why the resurrections are an essential part of that plan. The world doesn't. Maybe we could say it's because they weren't given to understand. Who knows? But it is a privilege to know God's plan. We learn more about the plan as we observe these fall holy days. It's important. There's a message. It's contained within these days. There is the millennial age, and there is the post-millennial age. The millennial age falls between the first resurrection and the one that occurs 1,000 years later. The post-millennial age falls between the second resurrection and the resurrection to final sentencing. Those who are condemned in this generation, from our age, from the Christian era, won't experience the second resurrection. They will sleep on through. The rest of the dead will be raised after the 1,000 years. We could say the rest of the dead will remain in their graves and stand only for final sentencing with those who were raised before them to live out the rest of their lives with the opportunity to become converted in the second resurrection era. We know that there is a better resurrection. It's referred to in Hebrews 11:35. The better resurrection is our hope. We shouldn't necessarily be looking for the second resurrection. This resurrection offers an extra 1,000 years of life in the Spirit with God as civil and religious leaders in the world to come. Let's look at 1 Thessalonians 4. I got to page 5 already. Look at that. 1 Thessalonians 4. I'm not reading this because we don't know what it says, but it offers something that is important to us as an expression of our hope. 4:14. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so them also which sleep in Jesus will God bring with him, referring to the first resurrection. For this we say unto you, by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord shall not precede them which are asleep. Precede them as being raised into the family, into the spirit-born kind. For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so shall we ever be with the Lord. Wherefore, here's the important verse. Wherefore, comfort one another with these words. Because you see, our hope is not just a personal hope, but it's also a collective hope. The family will be raised together. The living and the dead will rise together to meet him in the air as spirit beings, given powers that we couldn't begin to believe even if we were told of them. That is the important component in our spiritual lives, the hope that lies within it. It should lie within us. This hope should be ever before us, at least in the backs of our minds and as appropriate as a forethought. Because when we begin to despair, when we begin to lose hope, when we begin to wonder what it's all for, Life isn't easy. We heard about that earlier. We're not promised an easy life. But it's training, because we're going to be working with people that had worse lives than we ever had. So it's important that we maintain hope, that it's the core of our being, in a sense. After the final judgment takes place, there's going to be an event that also should be in our peripheral hope. It's found in 1 Corinthians 15. And that's the other place that refers to this event that occurs at the second coming. 1 Corinthians 15, about verse 24. I'm going to start in verse 22. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. But every man in his own order. Christ the first fruits. He's the one that was raised first to open the church era. Christ the first fruits. Afterward, they that are Christ's at his coming. So between Christ's resurrection and his second coming, that's where we are here in time. Verse 24, then cometh the end when he shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power. Christ was given the mandate that we read of in Psalm 110, verse 1, that he was to rule until he had conquered all enemies, the last of which was death. What happens after that? When the last enemy is conquered, what happens? Continues in verse 25, for he must reign till he has put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. And in Revelation 20, we read that there is a point in time when even death itself, death and the grave, are going to be folded into the lake of fire and consumed out of existence. There won't be anyone left capable or worthy of death at this point in time. The last enemy that should be destroyed is death. And here referring to Psalm 110, for he has put all things under his feet, but when he said all things are put under him, it's obvious that he exempted himself, which did put all things under him. And when all things shall be subdued unto him, then shall the Son also himself be subject unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all in all. Christ is going to turn over the kingdom, this huge family of spirit beings, to the Father after all this is done. After the final judgment is completed, when the only beings left alive at that point in time are spirit beings, Christ will have accomplished his mandate to rule until, and we reach that point in time, he's going to turn the kingdom back over to the Father. That it says that the Father may be all in all. Can we even begin to comprehend what that's talking about? We are going to be brought into the very family of God as co-spirit beings, living forever with him, he being the greater entity into which we are absorbed. It speaks of a full unity within the family of the Father. Is that your hope? Perhaps you haven't thought about it, but I expect it is. But we have a great hope. And that hope, like it says, should be the anchor of our souls, the anchor of our lives. Let's not forget the purpose of this day. Because this day, what it pictures, is going to open that hope to all of the rest of humanity. They will know what we know someday. They will have the hope someday that we have now. I hope this feast has been profitable and enjoyable, and may we have many more.